Dan, for that great overview. Our second speaker is Dr. Stephanie Bialik, who leads the herpes virus team in the Division of Viral Diseases in our center at CDC. Her group conducts studies on the epidemiology of varicella, herpes zoster, and congenital cytomegalovirus. Prior to joining the Division of Viral Diseases, she worked as an epidemiologist in CDC's Division of Viral Hepatitis. She received her medical degree from New York University and her MPH from Johns Hopkins. The title of her talk is Zoster Vaccine, the Boomer Vaccine.
Good afternoon. Today I'm going to give an update on herpes zoster vaccine. Every 7 seconds, another baby boomer turns 60 and becomes eligible for zoster vaccine. Today I'm going to talk about the epidemiology of herpes zoster, zoster vaccine effectiveness and safety, zoster vaccine uptake, and what some of the key research and policy questions are that we're facing. So what is herpes zoster and who's at risk of getting it? Infection with varicella zoster virus, VZV, initially causes varicella or chickenpox. Following infection, VZV establishes a permanent latent infection in dorsal root ganglia along the entire neuroaxis. And then years later, VZV reactivates and presents as herpes zoster, a painful rash. It's generally a unilateral rash in 1 to 3 adjacent dermatomes, and the schematic on the right shows the distribution of the dermatomes across the body. So it has a very distinctive appearance. It generally presents as macules and papules that form over 5 to 7 days and evolve to vesicles. And then the rash generally resolves over the next 25 days. One of the primary manifestations of zoster, other than the rash, is pain, and the pain can be excruciating. It's been described as aching, burning, stabbing, and as painful as childbirth or kidney stones. Other prominent symptoms include unbearable itching, and the patient shown in the photograph on the right had such unbearable itching from his zoster that he actually scratched through his scalp, and you can see that in the inset of the CT scan in that photo. One of the other serious complications of zoster is herpes zoster ophthalmicus. About 15% of zoster cases involve the ophthalmic distribution of the trigeminal nerve. Untreated, 50 to 70% of these patients can develop ocular complications, which can lead to reduced vision or even blindness. And then the most common complication is postherpetic neuralgia, or PHN. And that occurs in about 20% of zoster cases. It's pain that persists after the rash has resolved, and it can last for months or even years. Managing PHN is quite challenging. Opioids, anticonvulsants, tricyclic antidepressants are used to treat the pain, but they often offer only partial or inconsistent efficacy. And the side effects, especially in the elderly, can really be substantial. So in contrast to a lot of the other vaccine-preventable diseases, zoster is really a disease in which pain and suffering makes up the most of the disease burden, and it can result in significant physical and social disability and lead to depression. So now I'll talk a little bit about the epidemiology of both zoster and postherpetic neuralgia. In the U.S., there are about 4 zoster cases per 1,000 population per year, or about 1 million cases a year. Overall, 1/3 of persons will develop zoster at some point in their lifetime. Of persons who develop zoster, 20% will have 30 or more days of pain, and 10% will have 90 or more days of pain, which translates to between 100 and 200,000 postherpetic neuralgia cases per year in the U.S. Turning to risk factors, age is the best described and predominant risk factor for zoster, and as this graph from one of the seminal papers on zoster demonstrates, the risk of zoster really increases dramatically as people age, starting around the age of 50. And the same is true for postherpetic neuralgia. The risk of PHN is increased 27-fold among persons with zoster who are 50 and older compared to persons with zoster who are younger. So age is a dominant factor that drives incidence and burden in the population. The other important risk factor for zoster is immunosuppression. Conditions such as hematologic malignancies, such as lymphoma or leukemias, bone marrow transplantation, or AIDS, can all cause immunosuppression, which increases the risk of zoster up to 50-fold. Both age and immunosuppression are thought to impair VZV-specific cell-mediated immunity, which usually otherwise prevents VZV reactivation and the development of zoster. So why do 25% of seemingly healthy persons develop zoster, and how do they differ from the 75% of healthy persons who do not? And that's sort of the million-dollar question, which unfortunately we don't have the answer to. It's important to understand this because it helps us understand the epidemiology of the disease, and it'll also be critical for being able to monitor the impact of the vaccination. Some of the other risk factors that have been explored for zoster include gender and race, and these two factors show up pretty consistently in most studies. It appears that females have a higher risk of zoster, and that zoster is more common in whites than in blacks. The rest of the factors shown here have not been as consistently demonstrated in studies, and although they may very well be risk factors, they probably don't explain the bulk of zoster disease that we see. Other conditions include things like diabetes, physical injury, stress, depression, a family history of zoster, and across the population, potentially declining varicella exposure. Now I'll turn to discussing the zoster vaccine. Zoster vaccine contains a live attenuated strain of VZV, and it's the same strain that's used in varicella vaccine. Zoster vaccine's minimum potency is 14 times that of single antigen varicella vaccine. It was licensed in the United States in 2006, and CDC currently recommends a single dose of zoster vaccine for adults 60 and older. Just this past week, the FDA approved an expanded indication for zoster vaccine in persons 50 to 59 years of age, and I'll touch on that again briefly at the end of my talk. Most of the data that led to licensure and recommendation of zoster vaccine came from the shingles prevention study that was published by Oxman et al. In 2005. It was a double-blind, placebo-controlled, multi-center trial that enrolled 38,000 healthy subjects more than 60 years of age and randomized them to receive either zoster vaccine or a placebo. And then they were followed for about 3 years. And the key things that we learned from that study is that the zoster vaccine appears to be safe. There was no pattern suggesting a causal link to serious adverse events. Varicella-like rashes were rare in vaccine recipients, 0.1% in both vaccinees and the placebo recipients. However, local injection site reactions were more common in vaccinees, and as you can see here, they were fairly common, about 48% of vaccinees compared to 17% of placebo recipients. In terms of vaccine efficacy, the overall efficacy of zoster vaccine for preventing zoster in this study was 51%. And 66% for preventing postherpetic neuralgia. The graph on the right shows vaccine efficacy by age group, the white bars showing vaccine efficacy against zoster, and the red bars showing vaccine efficacy against PHN. And as you can see, vaccine efficacy for zoster appeared to decline with age, that it was less effective in the older age groups. However, vaccine efficacy for PHN was fairly consistent across all age groups, although you can see it was lower in the oldest age group here. So now I'll show the data that we have on zoster vaccine coverage, and the graph is encouraging in that it shows that zoster vaccine coverage has been steadily increasing since 2007. Although, as you can see, in 2009, coverage was only 10%, so it still remains quite low. So why is zoster vaccine coverage so low? There are a variety of reasons. Some of them are the same issues that we see with some of the other adult vaccines. Providers face a number of barriers. They have competing priorities when caring for older patients who have multiple chronic diseases and acute care needs. There may be lower familiarity among providers with adult vaccination recommendations. For patients, many of them face fragmented care with a variety of providers, none of whom are responsible for their overall preventive care. And then there are a host of system barriers, such as a lack in the past of a comprehensive financing system for adult vaccination, and a lack of institutionalized well adult visits like we see in the pediatric realm. And then there are a variety of barriers to zoster vaccination that are somewhat unique to zoster vaccine itself. Probably one of the largest barriers has been supply disruptions. There have been repeated problems with the production of bulk material for zoster and varicella vaccines since the zoster vaccine was licensed. It's led to limited marketing and promotion of the vaccine by the manufacturer. It's limited provider familiarity and experience with using and recommending the vaccine, and it's hindered planning of public sector activities to increase zoster vaccination. There are barriers to zoster vaccination that are related to storage and handling. Zoster vaccine must be stored at freezer temperature, and it's the only vaccine for adults that requires freezer storage. Many adult providers are not equipped to handle frozen vaccines, and in a study published last year, 36% of providers identified this as a barrier to providing it. Price and reimbursement also pose a barrier. Zoster vaccine is currently the most expensive adult vaccine. The catalog price is about $160, and that makes it four times the cost of pneumococcal vaccine and 10 to 20 times the cost of flu vaccine. And so there's a high upfront inventory cost for providers to stock it. Fortunately, Medicare reimburses zoster vaccination through Part D. However, Part D payments are designed to reimburse pharmacies, not providers. And so although it's good that it's covered by Medicare, it actually does pose some barriers to patients receiving vaccine. A patient may need to pay full price for the vaccine up front and then file later for the claim to get reimbursed. Or the provider may refer the patient to a pharmacy for vaccination, creating another step to actually get vaccinated. Or in some cases, we've heard of patients obtaining the vaccine at a pharmacy and then carrying it back to a provider's office for administration. It's a process that's been referred to as brown bagging. And given the freezer storage requirements, it's obviously something that we don't recommend. And then to go on with pricing reimbursement, there are significant non-reimbursed costs associated with zoster vaccine. These include Part D deductibles, co-pays, and the Part D donut hole. And these can be significant for zoster vaccine to the extent that the non-reimbursed costs may actually be more than the full cost of another vaccine. So given all of these barriers I've just listed, it can be rather daunting to think about how to move forward. There's a lot of work being done to try and reduce these barriers, but they're obviously will take efforts on a variety of fronts and won't happen immediately. In the meantime, we can work on ensuring implementation to the fullest extent possible of zoster vaccine. And I just want to highlight a few issues related to implementation of our recommendations that we frequently get questions on. Zoster vaccine should be offered to the older elderly and those who are frail or have chronic illnesses. The oldest and frailest are least able to handle the pain of zoster or PHN. They have the least social and physical reserve. They're least able to tolerate the medications used to control pain. And they experience the largest burden of zoster and PHN, so that even with lower vaccine effectiveness, it's still possible to prevent a substantial amount of the burden of zoster disease in these patients. Residents of chronic care facilities should be included in vaccination activities if no contraindications exist. Zoster vaccine should be offered to persons 60 years of age and older who report a previous episode of zoster, and this is probably one of the most frequent questions that we get. Having more than one episode of zoster is not uncommon. There was a study published earlier this year that reported that the risk of zoster recurrence is comparable to the risk of having a first episode of zoster. So following an episode of zoster, there is no specific minimal time interval before one can receive the zoster vaccine. And then zoster vaccine should be offered to persons 60 years of age and older who are anticipating immunodeficiency. Because the vaccine is a live vaccine, it's contraindicated for persons who are currently immunocompromised. However, there are an increasing number of diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, inflammatory bowel disease, and psoriasis, that are treated with immunosuppressive medications. Persons 60 years of age and older who are anticipating immunodeficiency due to initiation of treatments for these diseases should be screened for eligibility to get zoster vaccine before starting such treatments and becoming immunosuppressed. So So I'm going to close with just a couple of slides about recent studies and key questions that we're still addressing. The first one relates to zoster vaccine effectiveness and safety in real-world settings. It's important to validate zoster vaccine effectiveness and safety under real-world conditions. The pre-licensure study subjects were healthier and less diverse than the U.S. population. And zoster vaccine has stringent freezer storage requirements, and so we want to understand what the vaccine effectiveness is under real-world conditions. Zoster vaccine effectiveness in field studies has been supported. The first paper reporting on vaccine effectiveness was published earlier this year in JAMA and reported that zoster vaccine was associated with a 55% reduction in zoster, confirming what was seen in the pre-licensure study. It also reported that zoster vaccine effectiveness was maintained across all age groups and among persons with a variety of chronic medical conditions. So now turning to safety, surveillance for adverse events due to zoster vaccine is obviously quite challenging due to the high prevalence of comorbid conditions among those 60 years of age and older. There have been some recent data on zoster vaccine safety in the field, and just as an example, using the VAERS data that was presented at the last ACIP meeting, there have not been any unexpected patterns for adverse events after zoster vaccine, and so we're not seeing anything concerning at this point. The key remaining questions that we'll be wrestling with over the next couple of years are these three here. The first is, what is the duration of protection provided by zoster vaccine? Currently, just one dose of the vaccine is recommended, but given that it's been licensed fairly recently, we have a limited amount of experience with the duration of protection that it provides, and so we'll be looking forward to getting more data on that over in the coming years. The second question is whether there's a role for zoster vaccine in persons with immunosuppressive conditions or on immunosuppressive treatments. And given the increased risk of zoster in these age groups, we're interested in seeing if there are any subpopulations or groups in whom the vaccine can be safely used. And then finally, the one that we'll be dealing or that we're currently working with now is whether among persons 50 to 59 years of age, the burden of zoster and the performance of the zoster vaccine call for expanded use in this age group. And there's an ACIP group that's currently looking at the data, and we'll be presenting this over the next coming months at ACIP. And that's all I have for right now, so we'll be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. That was great. I think we do have a few minutes for questions, and so if there's any of you in the audience who would like to ask a question, there's microphones in the aisles, and please go to a microphone and identify yourself when you're recognized. And while I'm waiting for people to go to the microphones, I'll ask a question to start. I know there have been supply issues with the zoster vaccine, and that has kept everyone except my neighborhood grocery store from marketing the vaccine, I think. What do we know about the outlook to have the supply increased? Is there an end where we think that these supply issues will stop being such a problem?
If there's someone from the audience from Merck, I'd welcome them to provide us with an update. In the press release that they put out last week when announcing the expansion of the indication for the use of zoster vaccine, they acknowledged that there have been and there will continue to be ongoing supply issues. They reported that there are currently back orders for zoster vaccine, which they expect to begin filling, but also acknowledged that they expected there to be some ongoing back orders in the near future, and that they were working on expanding production.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. I'm Gene Robert Jeffra from Arizona. What happened after one episode? You already given the vaccine, and there's a second episode of zoster attack. Do you give them a second shot, or do you? First of all, did you come to such cases?
Right. At this point, we just recommend one dose of zoster vaccine per person. We do hear about episodes of people who have had multiple episodes of zoster, and it really raises an interesting question whether or not there, as I sort of mentioned when I was talking about risk factors, whether there are certain people who are, for whatever reason, at higher risk of reactivation of VZV, if there's a family history. We don't really understand what's causing that, but at this point, we don't recommend giving them additional doses of vaccine. The vaccine isn't recommended for treating zoster, and it's not recommended to give more than one dose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rita Harding from Indian Health. With limited supply, be it the ability to buy it or just lack of stock, we struggle with who to prioritize. Do you go for the younger 60-year-old where you get the better effectiveness, or do you go for the older immunosuppressed? A real divided discussion in our facilities.
Yeah, it's something that we've had a lot of discussions about, and it's something we find very challenging given the limited information we have about all of the risk factors for zoster. You know, you mentioned the well-known ones, age and immunosuppression, but beyond that, there are clearly other things that are putting people at risk for zoster that are not well described, and not having that information makes it difficult to come up with a rational approach to figuring out who to prioritize for vaccine. I think the other thing that's affected that is not fully understanding for how long we would be under the current condition of having supply limitations, and I think getting a better understanding of that time frame may help us make some decisions about whether or not we do that. I think it would be a very difficult thing to do given how heterogeneous the population of 60 and older persons are. As you mentioned, there are some, you know, very healthy 80 and 90-year-olds, mm-hmm. and you know, for whom zoster would have a real impact on a very active life. There are persons who are 60, frail with a lot of medical conditions, and so I can see a lot of ways that mm-hmm. one might look at that. And I don't think it's an easy thing to answer. We don't have questions. How have you approached it in your program, or is it sort of just a discussion at this point?
We've gone two ways, primarily with the 60 to 69-year-old looking at the effectiveness of the vaccine, but also allowed leeway for clinical individual providers to pick other patients.
Thank you.
Okay. This microphone in the left-hand aisle.
Hi, my name is Flo Rice. I'm from Madison, New Jersey. I have two questions related to it. Usually when we give the vaccine, we say that it will not prevent shingles, but decrease the case that they would get, but it will prevent the PHN. Is that not correct?
That is correct. The shingles prevention study demonstrated that the vaccine was effective both at reducing zoster as well as reducing PHN, and was even more effective at reducing PHN. There was also some data from that study showing that among persons who had zoster who had received the vaccine, they were better able to carry on with their activities of daily living. And so the way you're describing the benefit of the vaccine is correct.
Okay. The other question is related to distribution. As you mentioned, a lot of the doctors are not able to store the vaccine or do not wish to purchase the vaccine, and as a result, we do provide it at the health department. Both with flu and zoster this year, we're starting to see the Walgreens and the chain CVSs and all that taking over and providing a lot of opportunity for people to receive it. But it does have implications on, you know, whether we continue to buy it or not. So I just didn't know what kind of direction to go in the future.
And I think it's going to, again, if someone from Merck is here and wants to respond, I think it would be helpful. I think what you're expressing is a very real challenge, and I think it's going to continue to be sort of a fluid situation over the next year probably. And, you know, I think the frustration that you're expressing is something that has been felt by a lot of public health departments and by providers. It's difficult to know how much to stock and where it's going to start. Be-